Zimbabwe was a medieval city-state found in what is today the Republic of Zimbabwe in southern Africa, which dominated the region as a wealthy trading centre across the 14th and 15th centuries. It is this city, in fact, that gives the country of Zimbabwe its name today. Zimbabwe was the term used in the Bantu languages to refer to groups of stone buildings. And Great Zimbabwe is so named to distinguish it from other lesser Zimbabwes, smaller stone settlements. And then in time, this name was given, as I say, to the modern Republic of Zimbabwe, which is still around today. Before the widespread colonization of the African continent in later centuries, Great Zimbabwe was the largest set of stone structures in southern Africa, and its ruins are still there today near the modern Zimbabwean city of Masvingo. And the story of Great Zimbabwe starts long before its buildings were actually built, as far back as the 2nd century CE, when the region around where Great Zimbabwe would eventually be built was settled by the Shona people. On this large grassy plateau, the Shona set up shop with domesticated animals and small settlements, settlements that would, in time, grow and thrive. In the following centuries, technological advancements such as pottery, metallurgy, and leatherworking saw the Shona people begin to trade their goods with other communities further afield, all the way, in some cases, to the eastern coast of the African continent. The Shona expanded their farms, raising all sorts of crops from pumpkins to watermelons, and continued to raise animals and livestock. This was a very prosperous civilization, and they expressed this prosperity through their stonework, with the ambitious and impressive stone buildings that began to be constructed across the plateau. Most buildings in this area at this time were made of mud and thatch. Stone buildings were, of course, far more difficult and far more expensive to construct, given the time and the energy and the architectural expertise that they required. But of all the stone buildings that the Shona built, none were more impressive than, of course, the stone city that would become known as Great Zimbabwe. People inhabited the hilly terrain on which Great Zimbabwe would be built for a great many centuries before the city actually came along, of course. But it's from the 12th century onwards that the grand, expansive buildings that made up this city began to be constructed. We don't have a direct record of the construction process or indeed a written history of Great Zimbabwe itself. The Shona people hadn't developed writing. But based on archaeological investigation, we know that the stone buildings that made up Great Zimbabwe were built from the 12th to the 14th centuries. Stone was quarried and very carefully worked to build these buildings. None of them used mortar, so the stone that they were made of had to be very deliberately shaped to hold together on its own. And considering that many of these buildings still stand or are in, you know, only partial states of ruin a great many centuries later, I'd say that the Shona stonemasons did a pretty bloody good job, all things considered. But what is it exactly, you may wonder, that they built? Well, today we divide Great Zimbabwe up into three sections, which I'll talk about now. Firstly, the valley ruins. Secondly, the hill complex. And third, the great enclosure. Firstly, the valley ruins, which represents the bulk of Great Zimbabwe, its eventual spread as a city from its centre. These buildings are spread out over around 700 hectares, quite a vast expanse, really, and represent, I suppose you could call them the suburbs of the city, if you like. There are plenty of stone buildings amongst the ruins, but also evidence of mud houses as well, indicating differing levels of wealth amongst the population. The valley ruins also involve stone fences and other smaller enclosures that were built for various purposes, obviously, you know, enclosing livestock in many cases. And as I say, the valley ruins are the most expansive, but honestly also the least impressive part of Great Zimbabwe. The ruins of these old buildings are scattered across a huge area, and while it makes for quite a picturesque landscape, these buildings don't make up the very impressive edifices, the imposing buildings that you can find in the other sections of Great Zimbabwe, namely the hill complex. The hill complex, which is, as its name suggests, a complex atop a hill, much more impressive to look at than the valley ruins, overlooking the city on top of a hill that on one side falls away in a sheer, steep, rocky cliff. You'll find the hill complex, a site that looks to have served both a cultural and a military purpose, and perhaps on top of that, a political one as well. We're not sure. We're not 100% certain on what the purpose of the hill complex was. It has thick walls, which would have been very easy to defend, especially, of course, on top of a hill. And so the hill complex likely had some sort of purpose as a citadel or as a fortress. There's also evidence as well that it was used for religious purposes, for rituals or sacrifices or even for burials for the upper echelons of society. And there are also indications that grand buildings once stood there on top of the hill, perhaps the residences of the ruling classes, prime bit of real estate for them, you know, beautiful view, bit of the breeze coming across the plateau. I'll tell you what, very nice indeed. Honestly, when you think about it, there's no reason that this part of Great Zimbabwe couldn't have been all of these things, right? A military fortress, a cultural, political, religious center, whatever. But whatever the case, it does seem to have been a very important part of the city. But the most iconic and recognizable part of Great Zimbabwe is, of course, the Great Enclosure. Built down in the valley below the hill complex, adjoining the valley ruins, the Great Enclosure is a large and very imposing group of stone structures. Built a bit later on in the history of Great Zimbabwe, the Great Enclosure was probably completed in the 13th or maybe the 14th century, and it consists of a huge round wall and an enclosure, almost 10 metres high and up to 5.5 metres thick in some places. Again, it's not exactly certain what the Great Enclosure's purpose was. It is the grandest part of Great Zimbabwe, to be sure. So it's possible that it was this area actually that served as as the living quarters for the ruling classes. There are ruins of an old granary tower, and with grain being a symbol of wealth in Great Zimbabwe, this would have almost been like a royal treasury in some ways. But it's unlikely, we can sort of rule out one potential purpose of the Great Enclosure, it's unlikely that it had a defensive role to play, because despite the size and the thickness of the walls, there are a great many gaps and gates and openings in the walls themselves, so the walls probably weren't built for defence. But overall, the Great Enclosure, and indeed Great Zimbabwe, is a fascinating example of the cultural and architectural output of an old African civilization. And the Great Enclosure, often used as the symbol of this city, often the first thing that'll pop up if you if you search for pictures of Great Zimbabwe, the most iconic aspect of the whole city, I think it's fair to say. But what did the civilization that lived in Great Zimbabwe actually look like? What was life like in Great Zimbabwe in its heyday? Well, at its peak in the 14th and 15th centuries, Great Zimbabwe was the capital of what we now call the Kingdom of Zimbabwe, a realm that we don't have a huge amount of information on because, again, no writing. But we do know that the influence that this kingdom held as a powerful city-state dominated local and regional trading affairs. A vast trade network expanded out of Zimbabwe beyond Africa even. Historical artifacts from as far away as China and Persia have been excavated from the ruins of Great Zimbabwe. So this was very much a city that was part of a global trade network, which actually won't surprise you all that much when I tell you what it is that the Great Zimbabweans were trading, something that has underpinned the global economy for as long as humans have essentially been trading things with each other, something that the Great Zimbabweans happen to have, luckily for them, abundant access to. Locally speaking, right, Great Zimbabwe was a regional economic powerhouse for a different reason. Locally, cattle were the greatest sign of wealth. Those who owned great herds were powerful political movers and shakers. But the real reason on a more global scale that Great Zimbabwe became such a wealthy and powerful city-state is actually very simple. It is the same reason behind a great many similar civilizations and peoples becoming immensely rich very quickly indeed. The very same reason, in fact, that my home city of Melbourne went from being a colonial backwater to one of the wealthiest and most important cities in the mid-19th century. I'm sure I don't need to tell you what this trading good is. It is, of course, gold. Great Zimbabwe was able to generate enormous wealth by gathering and trading gold, one of the cornerstones of not just its economy, but the global economy, of course. And I say the Great Zimbabweans gathered gold rather than just mining it, because the Zimbabwean plateau was so full of gold, you wouldn't believe it. You would just bloody trip over the stuff while you're walking around. It was in the rivers, it was in surface deposits, it was all over the place. The Great Zimbabweans did dig mines, open mines, dug to depths of up to 30 metres to extract gold from the region to then go and trade. So you can just imagine with this abundance of gold laying around the region, around the city, it wasn't long before this city-state became immensely wealthy and, of course, as a result, immensely powerful. However, interestingly, Great Zimbabwe never had a market economy. All the trading that was done for gold and whatever else was done by the ruling elite exclusively. They bartered gold away for other wealth or exotic luxury goods or whatever else. The people who were out there actually working, the people who were, you know, tending livestock or growing crops or going and gathering and mining this gold, they weren't the ones undertaking the transactions. The trading was actually only done, as I say, by the upper echelons of Great Zimbabwean society, by the ruling elite. Nonetheless, gold underpinned the success of the city, and its great wealth attracted more and more inhabitants as the years passed. At its height, it's estimated that Great Zimbabwe had a population of over 10,000 people, and perhaps a great many more, perhaps as many as 20,000. Certainly not much by today's standards. But for the time and for the place, Great Zimbabwe was indeed a very great city. However, this city eventually fell into decline sometime after the mid-15th century for reasons that honestly are still up for debate. It might have been due to neighbouring city-states muscling in on Great Zimbabwe's turf. It may have been overpopulation, bringing all sorts of new issues to the city. It may have been long periods of drought, forcing people to go elsewhere to try to find food. But the likeliest reason, in my view at least, the one that presents itself as the most simple and obvious, is the fact that the gold ran out. It's estimated that Great Zimbabwe produced over 500,000 kilograms of gold that was then sent off around the world through this trading network that they were attached to. And so eventually this gold had to run out. The vast gold deposits began to be exhausted in time. And when this happened, this would have led to a sharp reduction in the interests that traders had in Great Zimbabwe, which would have very quickly resulted in the decline of the city as its economy began to crumble. Whatever the case, by the end of the 15th century, it seems that the trading links that Great Zimbabwe had had with coastal civilizations had completely collapsed, and a huge number of people had moved away from the city, seeking greener or actually perhaps golder pastures. The Shona people would move and found a new kingdom, the Kingdom of Mutapa, and in time, Great Zimbabwe was abandoned. It was left behind and forgotten about, falling into ruin and disrepair. Until it was, say it with me, rediscovered by European explorers in the 19th century. What is this? Is this our seventh or eighth monument so far to have had this happen to it? But the rediscovery of Great Zimbabwe had a number, I'm sorry to say, of very unfortunate consequences, some of which we're dealing with to this very day. It was, of course, looted and pillaged by the Europeans who came across it in the late 19th century. Countless priceless artifacts were taken from Great Zimbabwe and displayed in museums all around the world. But the saddest part about this aspect of the tale is that these artifacts weren't kept track of very well. They got mixed up and lost in various collections all over the world. So it's very difficult to properly trace the stolen cultural treasures of Great Zimbabwe back to the city. But it gets worse. Here's the really tragic part of the tale of Great Zimbabwe. I expect there's a decent proportion of listeners who have actually never heard of Great Zimbabwe before listening to this episode, despite its immense importance as the oldest stone structure in southern Africa, as one of the largest and wealthiest pre-colonial settlements in this part of the world. And the reason that Great Zimbabwe remains somewhat historically obscure is because the history and the significance of Great Zimbabwe was, as soon as it was rediscovered by visiting Europeans and all the way through to the mid to late 20th century, it was immensely downplayed, almost repressed, I would say. Why? Why did people attempt to keep the story of Great Zimbabwe from the world at large? Well, as you may have already guessed, it was because of good old-fashioned racism. The idea that the native population of southern Africa had built and maintained such a grand and wealthy city for centuries, this didn't fit in at all with the prevailing European narrative of the time, which was that African people were inferior in all ways to all the other races. In fact, scholars and researchers at this time in Europe, they point-blank refused to accept the fact that the Shona people could have built such a grand city and instead came up with other, frankly, unhinged explanations for the existence of Great Zimbabwe. They proposed, for instance, that ancient Phoenicians had settled there, or Arabs, perhaps. They'd, you know, turned up, built this city, and ruled it as a far-flung client state, taking advantage of its riches from a great distance. This, right, the idea of, you know, of an economic colony half a world away seemed more plausible, more likely than southern Africans themselves building such a city in their own land. That's how determined European colonials were at the time to stick to their completely misguided ideas on race. Oh, yes, of course, certainly Arabs could have built this city. That's fine, but not Africans, not the Shona. There's no chance of that. Absolute nonsense, of course, but when more rigorous archaeological investigation of the site began in the early 20th century and when these theories were properly put to the test, when people like David Randall McIver, an archaeologist of the early 20th century, began to speak out against the racist assertions that the Shona couldn't have built this city, he was discredited. He was ignored. People were not ready to accept the idea that the Shona people could have built this city on their land under their own steam. Eventually, an archaeologist named Gertrude Caton Thompson was able to demonstrate pretty clearly that the city was indeed of African origin, and while there was still pushback against her ideas, by the 1950s it was at last accepted as fact by the scientific community. All the same, the colonial ideologies that sought to paint sub-Saharan Africans as racially inferior, they persisted a lot longer than they should have, and in the 1960s and 70s, in the precursor state to Zimbabwe, in Rhodesia, the official government line was that Great Zimbabwe could not have been built by native Africans. Information about the site was suppressed by the white ruling classes, the people who ran the governments of Rhodesia. Archaeologists were refused access to the ruins. The research that they did was widely censored by the Rhodesian government, meaning that Great Zimbabwe does not have the reputation it deserves on a global scale. Eventually, Rhodesia would fall and be replaced by the Republic of Zimbabwe, a nation with its own set of very serious problems, but one that got at least a little closer to the truth when it comes to Great Zimbabwe in recognizing its African origins. Indeed, if you go and look at the flag of Zimbabwe even today, you'll notice the little bird-like figure that's on the flag's left-hand side. This Zimbabwe bird, as it's known, is based on a stone carving that was found in Great Zimbabwe. Great Zimbabwe remains one of the most important examples of pre-colonial sub-Saharan African civilization, and it doesn't deserve to be overlooked as it has been for so long. This wealthy and prosperous city-state may not have fitted into the outdated colonial narratives that drove European imperialism across the world, but today we can recognise it for what it is, a medieval African city built by and built for medieval Africans.